What happens when engineering gets more complex than any code can handle? In this episode of the Lubot podcast, we're joined by Lukasz Skotny, founder of Enter FEA, a specialist consultancy for nonlinear FEA based in Wrocław, Poland. Lukasz is known globally for tackling some of the most demanding structural analysis challenges, from silos and tanks to pressure vessels and offshore structures. Today, we are talking about with him about his journey from academia to entrepreneurship, how nonlinear analysis changes the way we approach engineering, and what it takes to build trust through technical clarity. Lukasz, I'm very happy that you're part of here. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be invited. So thanks for having me.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Lubot Podcast, der Podcast rund um das Thema Bau. Ich bin froh, dass du dabei bist. Los geht's. First of all, it's a real pleasure to have you here on the podcast. And yeah, you're well known in the structural engineering field, especially structure analysis, FEA. And therefore, introduce yourself, say something about you.
yeah, I should start with, well, I am well known. Well, I've been an academic teacher for a decade. I taught steel structures at my local university. And since, like, as soon as I graduated normal studies, I started a PhD program and I started a company at the same time. If you're looking for business advice in podcasts like this, I beg you don't do this to yourself. Starting a company and a PhD at the same time is a bad life advice. But I didn't know any better back then. So luckily I'm a workaholic or at least like you stay being workaholic, I guess, but it's been a few rough years, but at the end of it, I became an academic teacher and I run a company. It's hard to believe, but it was like over 15 years ago. Maybe almost 20 at this point. So it's a long time, even though I feel that I'm still as young as I was back then. And I always wanted to tackle the most complex things. So at least this part of my plan really like got executed well. And I ended up working in fields that are challenging and interesting. And I get to do really funny stuff. But at the same time, I'm a teacher at heart. And while I try to, work at university as a teacher to kind of express myself this way, working at university was like difficult on many different aspects. And I simply quit, but now I do training and I do online courses and things of this nature. And I run a blog, so I can at least be partially a teacher to kind of rub this part of my personality. So that's more or less what I do. I design weird stuff, I do weird calculations, and I teach people how to do them.
Okay, and everything is about FEA, so finite element analysis. So in English or also in Germany or in general, we can also say FEM, so finite element method. So what was your motivation to found also here your new company of teaching people how to do this?
Well, I feel that, funny enough, I stumbled upon finite elements more or less by accident. Back when I was a student, this wasn't really that popular. I mean, people were doing some kind of analysis, but it was treated more like a scientific, theoretical studies. And when I started doing my PhD and I did the laboratory tests of the shells, my PhD tutor told me, look, it's like, 2010 or whatever year that was, and you need to do FEA to your PhD thesis to make it complete. Like it would be a good thing to do that. And my instant thought was like, oh my gosh, there will be so many theoretical mathematical procedures I will have to go through. I had no idea what I was getting into. And the first year or two were terrible. It was pretty brutal experience because I did it like, you know, like YouTube appeared when I was a student. Like there wasn't that many online resources back then. So I basically banged my head against the wall, and I did like test everything myself to learn myself how to do this. And it was a pretty frustrating thing. But as soon as, after maybe a year and a half, first nonlinear analysis of buckling started to converge, and I saw all those shapes working and understanding, I was instantly hooked. As soon as I got it, I realized, oh, well, this has insane potential. I already had a company. Of course, my company back then wasn't really doing FEA. We were mostly doing like structural steel design. But I tried to steer toward siloses and shell structures to be able to start using the skills that I work so hard to gain in actual business. And it turned out it was a good idea. So from there, it kind of developed naturally, I would say. It took some time, but I can't say that as soon as I heard about FEA, I was hooked. It took me a lot of effort to actually get the answers, get the plausible solutions, and then I was hooked. So it was love and hate, I guess.
Perfect. Yeah, this came together. So, and I have also learned FEA. And in my opinion, it can be taught very difficult, but it can make also very fun when you can apply the theory of FEA also on some practical examples. And in my opinion, every time when I also see your content, then this is exactly what you are trying also to teach, that it can make fun, it is enjoyable when you know how to apply the, let's say, very difficult theory on practical examples. How do you see this?
Well, if anything, I'm really happy that I worked at university for a decade, because this showed me really well that some people who are uncertain, they will hide behind complex terms and very long sentences because they might feel insecure about things. But if you sound very smart, people usually just leave you be. And I always felt the other way around. I guess maybe this is just how I was raised and how my mind works. My father has a PhD in engineering as well, and he taught me the practical part of it even before I went to university. So I remember him well when he went back from one of his lectures really, really angry because he had two rubber bands and he wanted to explain to the students how the self-stable systems works, and one of the rubber bands broke and he couldn't. And he was really like, he came back home for dinner that day and say like, how can you explain people what self-stable systems are without two rubber bands? And this is more or less the environment I was taught in and raised in. So to me, everything is just a set of springs, rubber bands, pencils, and things like that. So I kind of get this beautiful sense of how things work. So this in turn leads to a situation where I can convey it in a simple way. I feel that as long as I have to use complex words to explain something, this only means that I don't understand it enough. And at some point, it's all stories of very simple phenomenons we see around us every day. And if you can boil down the complex things to the simple things, this means that you understand how they work. And from there, it only takes a bit of imagination to use examples to explain it to people. And I always liked fantasy and role-playing games. So I guess that part of my who I am also gets reflected to it. So yeah, this is more or less how I approach it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. And now let's break the whole FEA topic in some steps. So first of all the audience who listen to this podcast, there are also some people from the architecture side and so on. What is FEA and why do we need this?
Okay. So, since this is a podcast and we won't use any visual images.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say this. FEA is just a fancy way of dividing a very complex problem into very small tasks you can solve one by one. But thanks to the fact that you're doing this automatically, you can break down insanely big things into very small, simple problems, and then connect the solutions of those small problems into one big picture of how things will behave. And this, of course, has a lot of theory, mathematics, and matrices behind it. But realistically speaking, I would say that it's just a way of solving big problems with small steps. And the beauty is that every engineer is taught how to solve things by hand, and it's a very useful skill to have. But very quickly in your work, you will encounter problems where you can't really justify using the equations you were taught to this particular problem because of some sort of complexity. Be it that you know how to calculate a beam, but suddenly something in the flange changes, and you know the equation you have simply does not match the real problem you're trying to solve, and you start to search for another equation that is more complex, and another equation that is even more complex, and soon enough you learn that we don't have all that many equations available. And then you realize, well, since there is no equation that governs this particular case, you basically have two options. On one end, you can say, well, this case looks kind of like the one that we have equation for, so I will use this other equation and some safety factors, or you can try to solve it more accurately if you don't have such an equation. And this solving more accurately basically have two possibilities. You either do laboratory tests to see what the capacity is, and this gives a lot of other issues you may encounter, or you try to, you know, do the FEA model and divide the problem into smaller chunks. The solver will solve those for you, and as long as you define the problem correctly, you will get an answer you're searching for, even though you didn't have the complex equation to start with. So that would be the tool that assists you in those complex cases. I often hear that when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I'm first to admit that while I do work only in nonlinear FEA, essentially my company does only that, apart from structural design, I would say that not all problems deserve this treatment. Some things are simple, and you know how to solve them without fancy FEA things, and in which case you're basically wasting effort on solving something simple using very profound and complex things. However, if you would flip through any design code, you will very quickly find that those simple solutions only apply to bisymmetrical cross-sections that happen to be like well-supported with fork supports, and no torsion is applied to them, and so on and so forth. And suddenly, when you have an L section that is in torsion and bending and so on, you're just lost, right? And not to mention, like, when you have shell structures or plated structures or whatever. So FEA has incredibly vast field where it can be applied, but it doesn't have to be applied all the time. That's for sure.
Yeah. And this leads me to my next very interesting question. So you have already mentioned, okay, shell structures, some L-shaped, maybe cross sections of beams. So when I will be, so now for the student, when I will be a structural engineer, where I will use FEA on which application areas? So where would I use this?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, since assuming that listeners are students, that would depend on what you're studying. Like, I assume that it's either civil engineering, some sort of mechanical engineering, maybe naval architecture, something along those lines, right? So then I would say that you could use, like, to sound grandiose, I could say that you could use FEA wherever. Every application will be useful. Because, like, when I started my career, the best paying jobs was to do, like, very simple drawings of very simple elements to companies abroad, because they paid in foreign currency, the exchange rate was great. So I had a PhD, and still the one of the best businesses would to be draw, like, steel handrails in some stairs and things like that, because they paid the best back then, right? And I could tell you for a fact that some of the connections there were so complex that it would actually be meaningful to do an FEA analysis of them, right? So that would be, yes, things usually are far more complex than people assume and they are aware of. And usually, like, I have online courses, and people, when they come to office hours to ask me questions, they usually end up surprised how complex the problem they're trying to solve is. They thought that they only have one question, and suddenly I said, like, but look, you need to solve this and this and that and that and whatever. And it's way more complex than people think, right? So everything is. The problem of real life is that in many cases, the people who pay you or who employ you do not care. So I could spend 2 weeks on doing a beautiful, very complex FEA model of a very specific handrail connection detail that actually, engineering-wise, would require it. Nobody cares. It's just not a field in which quality control exists sufficiently to someone to say, well, mate, the design you did for those handrails is just wrong, right? People don't care. Like, you just do it. So I would say that, firstly, working in fields like that is basically a bad idea career-wise, FEA or not. Mostly because this is a race of who will do it the cheapest and the fastest, and the natural winning of this race means that you do it in zero time for free, right? So that's not a good place to be in as a professional in general. So if you would like to use FEA, you need to work in an environment that actually cares for a very accurate answers that are required and appreciated by the industry you work in. And this assumes things like things are heavily controlled. For instance, every pressure vessel we design has to go through certification. Every page of calculation is checked. Somebody is saying, hey, how did you fulfill this, that? Then before the manufactured pressure vessel gets used, it's actually tested with pressures higher than those that will actually be in the site where it will be used. So the margin of errors is very, very slim. And then you have to be accurate. So by nature, people appreciate accurate solutions, things that work in industrial applications where fatigue is present or very complex buckling phenomenon. Those do not really have much warning before failure in many cases. So you need to be very precise, and those are very, very well tested. And I would say that while you could use FEA everywhere, only those fields care enough to pay you sufficiently for you to make it like to make like career business sense of doing those analyses. Those would be the fields. And whatever this may be in your particular field of engineering, like just look around and ask people that are maybe a bit older than you on LinkedIn or wherever, like, is it hard to work in this field? How the venting process works? How many returns of designs do they have? Who is checking that, and how well? Right? And if somebody says, no, we always do it like the same way, nobody ever asks any questions, then this might not be the best field. And if somebody says, well, every page is scrutinized and checked very well, then most likely FEA will be very well used in that field. And also, it's a good field to work in general, regardless of FEA.
Yes, I can underline this, definitely. All right, so you were also talking about, yeah, let's say, some errors, and especially that not for each structure or model or problem I really need an FEA. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's neglect this thing. When I really use FEA, and now we can also dive a little bit into more technical details.
Sure.
Which problems or which mistakes, which common mistakes or pitfalls you are facing quite often when structural engineers, maybe also students or beginners, start using FEA?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily limit this to beginners, because if you went to a company and some old guy taught you how to do things his way, and you've been doing this for 30 years, it doesn't mean you have 30 years of experience. You just repeated one process for 30 years. That's not necessarily the same thing. And I've been, at this point, I must have trained at least 1,000 engineers in various like company trainings and so on. I'm not even counting like online courses, because then it would be a much higher number. And so I found enormous amount of senior people who just didn't understand what they were doing. They were just doing what they thought was best. Nobody ever explained it to them. It seems to work. So they did something. But when you ask them, why do you do this? Like, it's a crazy idea. Like, what happened? They usually say, like, I don't know. Like, I always did it this way. Is it wrong? So it's not necessarily like new people. And if anything, I would tell like new people, when you're searching for a job, you're basically searching for a boss, not necessarily for a salary. you're searching for somebody who will actually explain to you how things work. Because the worst thing you can do is have like a figure who you think is a person who understands stuff, and that figure doesn't know it, but won't tell you that they don't know it. They will simply tell you, do it this way, do it that way, without explaining stuff, because it actually changes what you will accomplish in the long run. So that would be important. But when it comes to direct technical problems, I feel that the biggest one would be boundary conditions, how you support your models. Very few people think about it. It seems very obvious. Oh, I will just apply like a pinned connection, fixed connection, like a pinned connection along this line or whatever else, right? And I really seen bizarrely stupid supports in models that conducted insanely complex analysis. You know, you can have like a super high speed impact of something, but it was just stupidly supported. It had no chance of working, regardless if it was linear analysis that you could do on paper, or was it like super complex, explicit dynamic something. The stupid supports make it stupid no matter. The problem is that the more complex analysis you do, the more you think about yourself as an expert. And so, no, it must be correct because this analysis is so complex and I know how to do it, right? But when the basics are wrong, it's just wrong, but you don't feel it. FEA will always look smart. Whatever you will print on your screen, it looks like $1,000. You know, all the colors changing, deformations. You look at it like, yep, I'm smart. And everything screams to you that it's right. And it takes like a pretty deep insight to realize, well, that's just dumb. You know, and it can be. So without a doubt, the way we support structures would be like the biggest issue, hands down. I think that when it comes to meshing, so how you divide your model into those finite elements, I feel that people usually end up on two sides of the spectrum. On one end, there are people who just don't care. They will just press mesh, and whether it's 1 meter by 1 meter or 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter, they just don't care, right? So when you are in that club, that's not how it's supposed to be. That's a bad idea. Like those, like it can end up being really bizarre. You know, you get to hear those like advice like, oh, if you have a point load, just make a big element so the stress averaged out or something. That's just not the way you want to do engineering at all, right? But on the other hand, there are people who kind of realize this and now they are scared. And they will say like, oh, wow, so now I have to have those super small, very tidy elements everywhere. And if they will spend weeks like perfecting the mesh, and it's also not awesome. Well, it's way better for sure, although it's extremely resource and time intensive, because not only you will spend a lot of time doing the model, you will also spend a lot of time computing it, and then you need a huge hard drive to store the outcomes. And if this sounds stupid, we actually have to exchange servers from now and again, because we are like putting insane amount of data onto hard drives, and you know, then you just need new hard drives and more of them and more of them and so on. So you want to be careful with that as well. It's like even simple things like how many seconds the model will open. Well, that depends on how many gigabytes of data you have in it, right? So somewhere in the middle is the best ground when it comes to meshing, but of course this comes with experience. And if you're not sure, it's better to have two small elements and too good and spend too much time, because at least you're safe. But be aware that, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect everywhere all the time. It has to be perfect or nearly perfect when it matters and when it counts. So that would be something that I think that people are usually on both extremes, rarely in the middle. So it's like a weird conundrum that I can't pinpoint where the problem is. And then the third one would be justifying the outcomes no matter what, because they look smart, right? If I would get paid a reasonable amount of money every time somebody claims that this must be good because we always did it this way, I wouldn't have to work. I would just go to meetings and talk with people. It would be enough. So that's a big issue. And I feel that the most common pitfalls would be, let's do linear analysis. We get very high peak stresses and we will say, oh, this is an FEA error of some sort. Those stresses are unreal and therefore they are not there. and you move on, right? Well, kinda, but no, not really, because something is happening there. You, like, if you have a beam and you apply a single force in the middle, under this force is the worst place. You just can't ignore it because it looks artificial. You still have to solve it somehow, right? So people will justify crazy things and ignore crazy problems simply because they don't know how to tackle them by, for instance, doing nonlinear FEA, but even thinking about it, you know? Like, sometimes you just see, oh, the stress is like 10,000 megapascals. Clearly it's wrong. I will ignore it and move on. Like, that's engineering-wise, that's usually a stupid idea to just ignore something because you don't know what to do with it. This doesn't lead to success in most cases. And the next similar approach would be with stability. People usually do linear buckling. And while in beam structures, it has some merits and it's useful, it's not an indication of capacity. It's more like a tool that you use to assess things later. And very often I meet people who simply treat linear buckling analysis as a tool that simply tells you this is or is not strong enough. In beam structures, that's a bad idea. In shell structures, it's a terrible idea. And so I would say that relying on linear buckling in general doesn't strike me like a great approach. I mean, I do use linear buckling very often. I just understand that it's only a small step that will allow me to assess something that I have to further verify later. And usually the capacity, the correct capacity I get is much lower than what a linear buckling would indicate. And the more complex stability problem is, the bigger the discrepancy gets. So relatively speaking, it's very easy to overestimate capacity with linear buckling heavily. And this is also something I've seen many times. And the last one would be simply, and it's an engineering problem, not necessarily a FEA one. People tend not to see all the problems they have. Very often, since I have a design company, people reach out and say, hey, we have this or that problem. We want you to solve it. And I'm so like, sure, great. This is what I do. I can make an offer for you. Could you send me the model so I can look around or maybe some drawings? And they send me the model and I say like, what about this? What about that? How did you solve this? This doesn't look right, right? And people were unaware of it. For the customers, I don't blame them. This is why they reach out to me. I'm a specialist. They have the design. And they thought they had only this problem. But, you know, when you go to a dentist and you think, oh, well, I have one sore tooth, and suddenly you learn that you have five, like, this is his or her job, right? That this is how it's supposed to work. But very often, I have, like, customers sending me reports from somebody else and say, like, was it done correctly? And in those reports, it's not that something was done wrongly. It was not done at all. Somebody was unaware that there is a problem they have to tackle. Usually fatigue, sometimes buckling. Very often, like, various phenomena, like weird combination of loads that may or may not cause some trouble later down the line. I feel those would be like the biggest issues, I think.
Mm-hmm. At the end, FEA is just a method, a numerical approach on how to solve problems. And we as users, we should always see this as a kind of helping tool. Yeah. And at the end, it's always the user and the structural engineer who decides if it's correct or not. And it's like a calculator. Yeah, it's like a calculator. Well, so when rubbish goes into the calculator, I can also only expect rubbish or trash.
That's true, although I would say that FEA can potentially do a bit more for you. Well, I admit that at the level of skill required to get there, you usually have the skill set ready to solve the problem anyway, and you would figure it out FEA or not. However, it happened to me once or twice during like almost 2 decades of experience that FEA actually found something I was unaware of. Mm-hmm. You know, if you set up your model correctly, aiming to check a failure of something, it may fail in a way you haven't predicted. And sometimes this means that your model setup is stupid. But sometimes under careful analysis, you realize, whoa, there is an effect I had no idea that exists. And it seems that FEA shows that it exists, and you start reading about it, and you learn, whoa, there was like a very edge case scenario in which something happens, or, I forgot about this or that or whatever, right? And so FEA can double check you as a professional, but this instantly assumes that you know how to correctly set up your model, run analysis. You know, there is so much you need to know to hope for that this is not a strategy. It's like a fail-safe. You should always know what you're doing. But from time to time, if you're lucky, you may find something in your analysis you were just unaware of. So that's like a nice bonus, but I wouldn't treat it as the primary source of understanding what you're doing. That's a very bad like order of things. You should know.
Sure, absolutely. So would you see also FVA as a kind of dangerous potential? Because at the end, you can produce any result by, let's say, modifying different parameters like meshing, boundary conditions, and so on.
Yes, I would say that you can harm yourself professionally with FEA. And that's an issue we will have to struggle more and more with, I think. You know, when I was starting to do FEA, you literally have to be able to code at least a bit to write a script of some sort. You kind of had to understand a few things here and there. And the assumption was that you're doing some sort of PhD. Like that was like the climate around FEA, right? So then, like, I don't want to say more smarter people used it. That would be rude and not really true. But there was a very small selective group of people that by nature had a lot of time to fix problems. So when you're doing a PhD, you have years to master solving a specific case. So even if you fail at first three tries, nothing bad happens. You just don't get a correlation between the test and your analysis, and you know, you do the next try. But if you're like a practicing engineer and you're designing a building, failure is not an option, right? And then you don't have several years to design it. You might have weeks. And suddenly, there is a huge pressure on you to do a very difficult thing without much preparation, very fast and reliably. And this speed also connected with thinking that, this is a software that I bought. It must be good, so it must do this correctly kind of vibe. From time to time, you see marketing of various programs that kind of advertise this, use our wizard to do whatever, it will design the car for you, or like a rocket or something, right? And it seems that anything can be done on your cell phone in 5 minutes by 10-year-old, right? If design would be so simple, you wouldn't study it. It would be a topic in high school or maybe a class in kindergarten. Well, sadly, it's not that simple, right? And as the tools get more easy to get access to and easier to use as well. I mean, like using the old versions of FEA programs would make current FEA specialists cry blood. Like finding a button that does anything in those, it's like a freaking nightmare. It was terrible. Now everything is nice and dandy. The icons look beautiful. Everything is sleek and optimized for the amount of clicks and stuff, right? So it seems that it's easy, but actually it hasn't become easier. Engineering, if anything, it's get more and more difficult the more we optimize the designs, but it seems easy. And this, the fact that it seems easy connected with the fact that you might be in a severely big time pressure to finish what you're doing, connecting with the fact that you may not have the experience with it, this might actually be dangerous, because in the time pressure, you may do something dumb thinking that you did something smart. And if there is no verification along the way, this can turn out to be very ugly. And, you know, one of the best examples would be the Sleipner offshore platform. They drowned like entire oil rig because the mesh was too big. The costs were in 100 millions. So, you know, somebody had a bad day at the office. That's for sure.
So you've already mentioned some, let's say, unique challenges also of steel structures, fatigue analysis, buckling, linear, nonlinear. So a significant part of your work is also involves steel structures, which bring their own unique challenges. Maybe you could give us a short overview about the challenges you encounter in steel design.
Okay. So I rarely do very basic steel designs, like the easy ones. The things that we do are usually like movable parts, like moving formworks for bridges, semi-machines stuff, conveyors, things like that. Right. So usually understanding the problem would be difficult. I mean, designing a steel structure, apart from irritating facts like how the hell to calculate lateral torsional buckling of a C-section, that is bent in both directions. It seems that in 21st century, we would have to figure it out somehow, but like apparently we have to wait a bit, right? So if you're aware of those things, you just apply a reasonable safety margin and move on, right? So this is not a, it's a stupid problem because we can, like, you know, we have rockets on the moons and we can design like various crazy things. But if it has like 8 meter C-section, things tend to get iffy. But apart from those problems that simply come from lack of research and lack of like theoretical solutions for those, I feel that the biggest issue would be to understand what you have, what problems you have. Because designing steel structures in essence is quite easy. They are very well codified. You have Euro codes or ANSI codes or whatever. And those rules, while you cry blood when you read those, and it's not fun at all, those will more or less guide you through as long as you have at the back of my head that while reading those, that the fact that something is not written doesn't mean that it's not a problem. Because in Eurocode, you will always find chapter on how to calculate bisymmetrical double direction bending thing. But there is no chapter that we don't know how to calculate non-symmetrical sections, right? But it doesn't mean that we know. It was just like gracefully omitted, right? So you have to be very careful when reading. But apart from it, you know, those things tend to be automated in programs. And as long as you know what you're doing, I would say that the biggest two in steel design will always be the same, and that would be fatigue and buckling. Because in buckling, you know, you just can't assume a buckling length. You really have to understand what goes in critical bending moment, how this operates, and that usually things are way more complex than the typical axis steel equation, and you suddenly end up in a place you have no idea what to do. And with fatigue, especially in civil engineering, we aren't taught fatigue all that well at university. So this is something you kind of discover as you go, and then you have to figure out how to deal with that. So those two things would definitely be the biggest challenges. But of course, if something is rigid or a pinned connection would always be an issue. This must be one of the most popular articles on my blog, I feel, that like how to decide if this is a pinned connection. Because, you know, it seems so trivial, unless you start asking the right questions, and suddenly it's very complex. So those kind of decisions that are not necessarily related to FEA, well, they are impacting the FEA, but they would also impact any other form of solving the problem. You just have to know what to do. So those would be like the biggest challenges.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there one project, Lukasz, in particular that stands out for you? Because you learned there a lot, or it was in some way very difficult or challenging. Is there anything where you learned a lot?
I usually remember technical problems and people. So once we did pressure vessels for a lady who tried to pick me up. So that was hilarious experience. I was married like 10 years in, and she was literally flirting with me while we did the job. So the pressure vessels were nothing like fancy, just regular old pressure vessels, but the experience of it was pretty bizarre. So that's what I remember well. And also, I usually I'm blessed and cursed because I have Asperger's. So my mind works pretty weirdly. And I am very courageous. I collected in me insane amount of knowledge. And I'm pretty certain that if I don't know how to do something, I can learn as I go based on what I already know and a few books I need to read more. So from time to time, but not too often because I get tired. I'm an old guy. Like I'm 40. I get tired.
Hey, so, in the best age.
the best hopefully. Age. But I don't do this as often as I did it because when I was like 30, I could do it nonstop. Right now, like 1-2 complex designs a year where I really have to study a lot is like enough for me. Right? But at the same time, the studying goes faster and faster as you know more because it's easier to, you know, connect the dots. So I very often did things where I had to learn on the fly. This is how I started designing pressure vessels. A company reached out to design a normal vessel for them and then say, hey, you will design pressure vessels for us. And I said, like, I never designed a pressure vessel. I'm like, don't worry. You're good with FEA. We see that you're smart. You can do it as you go. And I did, right? And the one of the weirdest projects I did was silos that were welded to the decks of the ships that sail somewhere in Venezuela. And, you know, the ship is on waves, so there are accelerations to the size. It's not like earthquake. It's a very weird problem to have. So this is where I learned about, like, sea motion and stuff like that. And once a customer asked me what is the coefficient to multiply the wind from the US codes to convert it to European wind speeds. And like, it's a very complex phenomenon. And there is like a hurricane society that does tables for that was pretty interesting. So those are always those weird quirks that I simply had to learn on the fly that I remember the most. But it's not like a design of any particular structure. To me, the structure is just the byproduct of me learning interesting things. So many of the structures are just boring. You know, you do it and you move on. But when the interesting problems pop up, I wouldn't even know some of the interesting problems. I wouldn't be able to associate them with a design. I mean, they happened in a design. I just don't remember which design was it. I remember the problem, like how to strengthen a shell that fails in shear buckling. That I was designing a silo once that somebody designed and it like was close to failure and I needed to figure it out. That's a very difficult problem. So I don't know which silo was it, but I remember the solution to the problem. That was interesting. So to me, this is how it works.
Okay, perfect. Besides your design work, you have also built a strong educational platform through Enter FEA Academy. Also the motivation we have already clarified. And what can we expect from this platform? What can we find here for topics? And how is it also unique in comparison maybe to other, let's say, providers who also do something similar?
First of all, you can go to enterfea.com and then in the tab, there's Academy. And you can find a few free courses there that I did. As I said, I feel that I'm at least half teacher at heart, and the other half would be an engineer. And so this part of me connected with how my father taught me engineering is kind of what manifests there. So I explain everything using gummy bears, like rubber bands and things of this nature, simply because this is how I think about it. And to me, engineering is just like a flow of river. It flows and you kind of need to understand the current. It's not necessarily the rules, but rather like how the reality bends around things. And so this is what you can expect. You can go there, sign up for a few free courses, and you'll see how I teach, and that's cool. Of course, I also have paid courses that already trained hundreds of people, and maybe even more. And I started doing this as a hobby. I was pretty frustrated at structural engineering job, and I started my blog on FEA simply to kind of be able to express my interest in complex things without really the ability to exercise them all that often. It was a frustration thing. And I started writing, and I did it like very regularly. And after a year, I realized that it's just too much effort, and I just can't sustain it unless it starts bringing some sort of revenue. And since I didn't want to quit, I did my first online course, and then a second, and a third. And right now, the most pleasurable thing is that emails that I usually get that people say that they wish they had a teacher like me. And that's kind of like, this gets me going because that's the main benefit I get. I get to meet with people and talk with them, and they get to learn from me. That's cool. And if you would like, on 9th of December, so quite soon after this will be published, you can go to enterfea.com/webinar before, and I will have a live webinar, and it will be on December 9th, so you can sign up before and, you know, come live and see me. It will be about steel structure design, so it will be fun. And anytime in future you will listen to, if you go to enterfea.com/webinar, you'll be redirected to the next webinar that I do. And I love those. Like, we have like 2-hour long Q&A sessions, and we discuss things, and it's just, it's also a way of me being social without the necessity to meet a very big group of people in one place, which would be difficult for me. I would rather like talk in my safe space while meeting people. So if you meet me at the conference and you come and say, "Hey, Łukasz, what's up?" And I will be like, "Oh, shit." After a few people, like, sadly, this is sometimes how I react. So doing those webinars is like that. It allows me to be social with people without, like, it's easier for me this way.
Yeah. I like the way how you do this, because whenever you are a professor or a teacher at school, you're always limited to the people who are attending the school and the university. But what you are doing here is that it opens the whole community who are really interested. And the factor of where you're living, on which time you're joining. And so all these factors do not play any role. So you can share your knowledge, your valuable knowledge, to by far more people than the way in a school or university.
I understand, and I do agree. Like, if I would be an academic teacher since today, for today, for all that time, there was no way I would teach as many people as I did taught online, for sure. However, I have to admit that if you would be a company that would come to me and say, "Hey, could you train us in FEA?" I would say, like, sure, it will cost you more, but I will strongly advise you to fly me in to your headquarters so we can meet, because it's a more effective way of learning. That, it has to be said. It's generally true. It's just cheaper and more convenient to do it online, which in current day is not something to sneeze on. But when it comes to successes of education, the two, I have like three biggest success stories that I carry in me when I'm depressed. And two of those happened when I was an academic teacher. One was that I was depressed for many years before I was diagnosed. So if you happen to be my student when I was depressed and not know about it, and I was very dark, I apologize. Although my wife works in IT, and I usually start classes saying, like, "Why are you studying civil engineering? Go study IT." And there's like at least 10 people in her office that thanked her that I sent them to the IT department. But I usually ask people, like, because I was teaching shell structures, so it was like fourth or fifth year at university. I ask people very simple questions of how do you understand this and that and whatever. And I ask them, like, "Look, you spent 4 years here or 5 years here, and you don't understand this, 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 and that. What do you hope for?" And a few years after I finished working, I got an email from a student who said, "You know what? I was sitting during one of those classes, and you really shook me. And I understood that I was studying because my parents pushed me to it, and it made no sense. And I quit university. I opened a small company that does like electric things, and I hired a few people. I'm very successful now. And if not for the talk you gave, I would never have the courage to do that. And I want to thank you." And it's one of the three best success stories of engineering that I have. A failure in some sense, but at the same time success, because it only goes down to people. The second one would be a student that came to me and gave me a closed envelope on a corridor at university. You need to, like, the gravity was like, "Is this like a candid camera? Dude, like, seriously?" Like, so I opened it publicly, and it was a letter. And I still have this letter, and it says that you were the best teacher I ever had, and I want to thank you for that. And I once got an email about Kung Fu Panda, and the person who wrote it surely knows it. And the person even said that, "I know that you're depressed, so print it and keep it on the board so you can read it when you're down." And I still do. So
nice.
I feel that while teaching online gives you perks, an insane range, you can teach a lot of people, those in-person connections are only possible when you have like online meetings, like we have here, that you can actually, you know, touch somebody, not only record the lesson. That's why I include those in some of my courses, so people can come and ask me questions when things are more difficult, simply so we can talk. So, teaching online has a great range, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. As someone who has a lot of experience in FVA and also is in touch with a lot of people, it would be for me very interesting, how do you see the future, maybe in FVA general, or maybe also the construction industry? It depends on you how you would like to answer on this topic. But are there any trends you are facing right now which are also interesting for us in the future, maybe also in the field of FVA or even the construction industry itself?
Well, every time I get asked something like this, the first thing that comes to mind is that I'm incompetent to give you any answer. I'm an engineer, maybe a good one, but still just an engineer. I don't study trends. I don't study economics as such. And sociology is such vastly complex thing that, like, I have no idea what future holds. That being said, this year I was at Nathan's World and I held a workshop about the future of AI in engineering. And while I know next to nothing about AI, there is one thing I know for certain, and that is that the person responsible for the design will be the one that makes decisions. And I don't see AI being responsible for anything in any time soon. So if it doesn't take responsibility away from me, I am designing it. So it's just a calculator. And so I don't see huge revolutions. In 1971, Chris Field and Riggs, it was 71 and 72, they did it separately, wrote an arc length method that allows you to predict post-failure behavior of structures. And in 2015, when I was using this to design shells, people said like, whoa, this is such an advanced thing. Like, that's awesome. It's incredible. Like, to this day, when you animate a buckling failure of a shell, people say like, that's bonkers. Like, how did you do that? It's like, what, 50 years now?
Yeah.
So engineering, for a very good reason, tends to be pretty conservative. And engineers as people tends to be conservative as well. And while a lot of new tools will happen, a lot of new possibilities that will make our work easier in some sense, I'm pretty certain that things will be more or less as they always were. And that you need to be a very good engineer to design responsible designs, because that's needed. And I think that there was a study already published in IT sector that the AI can code for you as long as you are a senior engineer who already knows how to code and what you want to get. And actually, the AI only increases the efficiency of very experienced people, while it drastically decreases the efficiency of the beginners, because they don't know what to ask for, they don't know how, and it actually slows them down. So I feel that being a very good specialist in something will always be a good idea. And with this in mind, I am happy that I'm an engineer, because we tend to live in a society that values good engineering. Because, you know, I could be a poet. That would be more difficult, I think. And, you know, I don't recall a painter who was rich before he died. So we tend as people to value some things and we don't tend to value others. And it seems that engineering that hooked me was a good life choice. And I'm just happy, and I'm pretty certain this will not change. Circumstances will, tools will, but the knowledge and understanding will remain, and it will be in us, not in machines. So with this in mind, like, will we use like other types of screen or better, faster hard drives or whatever? Like, to me, it's just like, I just don't care, because cell phones didn't change the way I work. Very strong personal computers didn't change that much. and the next step won't change that much either, I think. And, you know, feel free to send me this clip in 10 years when we'll live in artificial intelligence simulation or whatnot.
I'm
more than happy to smile and say, well.
I was completely joking. All right. Perfect. Lukasz, at the end of my podcast, I have always the same question to my guests. And this is the question about your favorite structure or building. And now I'm very curious what it is.
Oh, I will kill you with this one. you see, I haven't watched TV news in like 8 years. I don't listen to radio. I'm not interested in culture, in pop culture in general. If anything, I'm interested in sociology. So I don't follow news at all, to the point that I purposefully avoid knowing what's going on. But when in Poland, when you study the fifth year of engineering, most people work. The last year is only like writing a master thesis and not much more. So you have at least like 3 out of 5 weekdays where you can go to the office and earn money. So before I started my company, I was actually employed for a few months in a company. And that company was designing a huge mall in my town, in the middle of my town. And when I was hired there, they were already finishing, but they needed to design a glass roofs above door, entry door to the stores. And those were like small things, like 2 meters by 8 meters with some steel cantilevers. And it was my first design in my life. And my boss, who was a very smart guy, took me into the car, drove me to the workshop nearby who built them and say, look, this is what you've designed. And I remember how afraid I was because this seemed so big. On the screen, it was so small. And when you stand next to something that is like 2 by 8 meters, it's huge. I was not prepared for that. And it's like, you know, stay humble. Like, this is how it looks. And every time I go to town, which rarely happens because I don't like crowds, but it happens, I see those glass roofs. I see that they are hanging on the tension rods that hang loose because the cantilever itself was strong enough, clearly, and it didn't need the hangers, apparently. And I look at that and I think like, yeah, stay humble. And it must be my favorite site because this is the first thing I ever designed on my own. Mm-hmm. And I remember how afraid I was when I saw this. So it's no super high skyscrapers, crazy bridges, and stuff like that. It's a thing that you will most likely fit into your living room made out of stainless steel. The cross section was 40 by 10 and 80 by 10 T section for a carrying beam. And it's this small thing. When I look at it, I think like, whoa, yep. And it gets me every time. So it must be my favorite building. And my favorite story would be in our town, Wrocław. If you've never been here, come. It's like, it must be the most beautiful city in Poland, for sure. Maybe.
Okay.
Okay, Toruń, you get the shout out. But Wrocław is just pretty perfect.
Okay.
And we have like a huge painting that is like a circular painting paint in a rotunda building. And the roof is hanging on the wires. And they weren't sure how big force was in those wires after many years of using this building. And they hired a professor who simply hit it with the hammer and measured the frequency of the sound to back calculate the strength.
Oh,
and I was like, huh, now that was an interesting idea. So that would be my favorite story for a building, I guess.
Okay, perfect. Hey, perfect. Very nice. Perfect story, perfect structure building. So also a kind of personal relationship and story behind that. Lukasz, with these words, I would like to say thank you very much for your participation. It was very nice. So I have learned some nice insights about FPA, about your projects and so on. And wish you for the future all the best and a lot of success.
Thanks. I wish you all the best as well. And thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure. And I always enjoy having good conversations. So, yeah, thanks for inviting me in and thanks for listening also. So, have a lovely day.